Welcome to the Send Mum Club podcast. I'm your host, Gemma, and if this is your first time listening, firstly, welcome along and thank you for choosing to listen. This is a parenting podcast with a difference because it is for, you know, mainly mums, but I'd love to know if dads are listening as well, of children with SEND. There are so many different diagnoses and conditions that fall under that umbrella, but they often present the same challenges. And I think it's a great place here where we can all learn from each other. I have certainly taken something from every single guest that I have had on so far. And I've found hosting this podcast already super, super helpful. And some things have definitely changed the way that I look at parenting my son, Leo, who is 2.5, who has Down syndrome. He is the reason that I wanted to start this podcast. And I'm really excited for you to hear the chat that I have had with Ebony Gilbert. So Ebony is my second guest who was suggested by somebody else. And I love this so much. Getting a message from somebody that I know, or it could even be a random message on the Instagram at the Send Mum Club of somebody going, oh my God, my friend's amazing. You should definitely speak to her as a guest. So Jodie, who I had on a few weeks ago, she was recommended to me by her friend Megan, and Ebony was recommended to me as a guest. And I am so happy that that happened. I loved Ebony's energy in this episode. I feel like we've got so much in common. She's this gorgeous, positive person. She's also really real and raw and honest, talking about her beautiful son, George. Now, George was born blind and he also has a few other medical conditions going on as well, which Ebony will go into in this episode. I actually learned quite a lot from listening to Ebony. And one thing that I found really interesting was Ebony talks about how she has learned to kind of change up the things that she thought would be great to do as a family, but actually weren't working. So she changed everything up, and she speaks so beautifully about this lovely life that her and her partner and George are living and how they've got to that point, but also her journey of acceptance, which, like so many of us, took a really long time. The other thing that I found super helpful in this episode is we talk about self-care, and Ebony has got some great tips on free, very quick things that anybody can do for if you're having those moments of overwhelm, which, let's face it, as parents, we all do. Everyone has those difficult days. And that was one of the parts of this chat that I enjoyed the most, actually, and things that I am definitely going to put into practice. Now, before we get into this chat, I do need to let you know that we had some sound issues when recording. You know, technology's great, but sometimes it's going to let us down. And this is just me. You know, I am recording this podcast. I'm editing it. I'm putting it out there. So it's all on me. I don't have a big team, unfortunately, around to help me. So the mic quality on Ebony's end isn't great, okay? But we live and learn. And there was a tiny part of me that thought, oh, I can't put this episode out. And then I thought, do you know what? It's too good. It's one of my favorite chats I've had so far. So please bear with it, because I promise you this episode is well worth it. All right, let's get into it. Ebony, hi, thank you for joining me.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You're one of my favourite kind of guests, and this has happened twice now. You have been recommended to me as a guest by essentially a mutual friend, haven't you?
Yeah, Ali. Yeah, I think I haven't seen Ali for a few years in person, but we're friends on Instagram, and she always follows a lot of my son George's stuff that I put on, and she always sends the loveliest message, and she was like, I know who you need to speak to. Gemma's got a new SEN podcast, and I was like, okie dokie. Here we are.
Do you know what I think's really nice, though? Like, it's a really lovely compliment, I think, because Ali and it was a girl called Megan recommended her friend Jodie, who's been a previous guest. And both of those messages have been like, oh my God, you have to speak to my friend. Like, she's so inspirational. Yeah. She's such a great mum. And I think it's so nice to know that people are talking about you like that behind your back.
Yeah, so nice. Yeah, we don't want to hear the other stuff. Nothing negative. We're not interested in that.
Just the positive stuff, please. Right, so Ebony, you have got a gorgeous little boy called George. How old is he?
So George is 9. He's going to be 10 in August. And I cannot even believe that. I sometimes feel like, oh, I've just had a baby. I'm like, oh, it's nearly a decade.
I know, it's such a cliche to say as a parent, isn't it? But it just goes so fast. It's crazy.
It really does. What do they say? I heard something. Is it the days are long and the years are short? or something like that.
And it makes my heart hurt thinking about things like that. I know. Though I just want it all to slow down.
And speed up sometimes, a bit of both.
Well, that's it, isn't it? You want it to speed up towards bedtime, but then slow down in general.
Yeah, slow down.
And sometimes school holidays to speed up as well, let's be honest.
Let's be honest, absolutely.
So
Easter holiday.
Oh my God, I know. Wow. So we'll obviously go deeper into everything in the episode, but just tell me a little bit about George to start with.
So George he was born blind. And we didn't know that he had a genetic condition that he was going to be blind.
Can I just ask, is that something that can be picked up while you're pregnant?
So potentially it could be if you were looking for a needle in a haystack.
Right, okay.
But because his is a very rare condition, it wouldn't be screened on kind of normal screening tests. So we didn't know, you know, it was a complete shock. The gene that he has also means we were told, you know, when he was a few months old, that would give him quite a high chance of having kidney failure at some point in his life as well. So that gene affects the eyes and the kidneys. He also had a stroke at birth, which is a completely separate thing. So that caused him brain damage and affected his right side, his mobility, and various other things to do with cognitive ability. So they're kind of the main things. And then a few years later, he wasn't kind of starting speaking or communicating, and he was diagnosed with profound autism, intellectual disability, you know, nonverbal. In the last about a year and a half ago, he developed epilepsy and the kidney failure. So that's the whole picture. And it's sometimes there are that many things that I sometimes forget something, and I'm like, oh yeah, he's blind also, just because it's. And I kind of laugh about it now, but, you know, sometimes it's really not funny, and other times I'm like, well, you know, it is what it is. But other than those things, he's a beautiful, cheeky, very handsome, very, gets away with murder and he knows it. Wonderful kid. Yeah.
So going back to when he was born, I mean, that there's two quite big things there, isn't there, immediately when he's born. And how did that feel? How did you cope with that?
So when he was first born, he was born at 33 weeks. Again, complete shock. You know, the waters went and we weren't expecting that at all. Emergency cesarean situation. He was in the NICU for a while. We stayed in the hospital for about 3 weeks, so not that long compared to, you know, some people, but long enough for it to be very difficult. But then we were sent home and told that everything was fine. So we didn't know anything was, you know, kind of amiss at that point. And then it was probably around 3 months after he was born, I became a bit concerned that he wasn't kind of making eye contact or tracking or... but he'd had his test and they said it was fine. So I took him to the doctor and they were like, no, it's fine. It's probably just, you know, like delayed visual maturation because he's new, prim. And so I was kind of holding on to that thinking, oh, hopefully that's what it is. And then it was another 2 months later. So he was almost 5 months old when we again took him and again were told it was fine. And then we took him to a private pediatrician, which cost a fortune on Harley Street. And he said immediately, you know, he's blind. I can't believe you've had to pay to come and see me to get this information. It is crazy. And he sort of, he said, I also work in the NHS at Moorfields Eye Hospital. Come to A&E there tomorrow and I'm going to fast track you kind of into the system because this needs to be, you know, addressed now. So that was the first major, major shock. You know, even though we've kind of knew something wasn't right, hearing those words, like he's completely blind, was absolutely devastating. Absolutely devastating. And my partner and I, we always mention this, you know, that day we came out of Moorfields and I had George in the pram and we went different ways. You know, I said, I'm going to go get a coffee and have a cigarette and sit on the step. And he went the other way and it felt really difficult. You know, we were both just hit with grief and shock. And then while we were, you know, trying to get our heads around that, I went into kind of instant research mode, which is what I do when I'm in pain and I want to fix something, you know, I want a solution. I still do it now, you know, and I in one way it's an amazing thing because I get a lot done and I learn a lot, and you know, we've made loads of amazing changes through that. And I just needed that at the time. I needed to look at, okay, you know, what kind of, you know, gene therapy could he have to make him see? You know, what can we do to stimulate his vision? What foods can we be giving him? All of that stuff. And I threw myself into that. It was then about 3 weeks. So they said, we're going to do an MRI scan just to look at the cause of the blindness. So it could be that it's genetic, or it could be an issue with the optic nerve. So if we do the brain scan, we can see if it's to do with the optic nerve. So 2 or 3 months later, after this blindness diagnosis, we went back to the same little room at Moorfield, and they said it's not good news. So the blindness is genetic. There's no issue with the optic nerve, but we also have detected brain damage. She's had quite a big stroke, and I mean, yeah, it probably took me about 2 years for that to sink in, because I just couldn't take any more in, and I think I was kind of like this, like quite detached. I think I just completely dissociated. I was like, I can't deal with anything more. And I focused everything on the blindness, and kind of, you know, when they're babies as well, something like a stroke isn't as evident, you know, until they get older. So I was like, oh, you know, maybe it's not that bad. And, you know, he's still going to talk. He's still going to walk, right? You know, he's still going to be able to do all of these things. And interestingly, I remember when George was about 3, we had a visit from, I think it was from an occupational therapist or a physio from the NHS. And she said, oh, you know, I'm here to talk about, you know, getting him a wheelchair fitted for future use. And I went, what do you mean? And she said, oh, you know, we talked about him having a wheelchair. And I said, why would he need a wheelchair? And she said, well, because he's had the stroke, he's not going to be able to walk. And I was baffled. I felt really angry. And I think I was just in so much denial. I was like, I don't remember her mentioning this before. And my partner walked through the door from work. She had left by now. And I was like, white. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, George has had a stroke. And he went, what? And I said, he's had a stroke. And he went, what are you talking about? And I meant when he was a baby. And he was like, what, thinking, you know, what the hell has happened, like, today? Like, what are you talking about? And it hit me for the first time. It took 3 years of kind of having to compartmentalize it so that I could be a mother to George and focus on the blindness, you know, first things first kind of thing. And then that started sinking. And then I started researching that. And, you know, so you asked me, how did it feel? It felt like shock, grief, terror, and later rage. It was overwhelming. It was really overwhelming. And I had a lot of fear for his future that for me kind of manifested in complete denial. Like, well, I said, you know, what is he going to be when he grows up? He's going to have a job and, you know, and yeah, of course he's going to be able to talk and walk and live independently. And I could not get my head around it. I could see another mum with her disabled child and feel for them and think, oh, I don't think they're ever going to be able to talk or walk or be independent. And she's going to have to look after them for the rest of her life. Oh, my God, how difficult. And the denial was so strong. And I was like, I realise now that's me. You know, that is how, you know, it's not the same for everyone. Some people, you know, the disabilities might not be as complex and that they do have the potential for that. But, yeah, it was brutal. And at the same time, I've never felt more love and joy at having my baby and my little boy in my life, who I'd always wanted a baby. And I was like, this is our happy ever after. You know, we're having this baby and this is it. And he's brought more love and joy into my life than I could ever have imagined. And it's also been horrendously painful at times, particularly the first few years. It's on a day-to-day basis now, it's not like that. I'm very glad to say that. You know, acceptance takes a long time, and acceptance doesn't mean liking something. It just means accepting it. And it's very different now. You know, most days, not all days, but most days, I think Steve and I are both, you know, we're just in love with him. Like, he's funny as fuck. You know, we're grateful, just so grateful to have him, and that, you know, he's taught us so much. And that sounds really cliche, but he really has.
No, I completely get that, of course.
they change you in ways that you cannot even fathom.
I completely agree. I think becoming a mum changes you anyway, but becoming a mum to a child with SEND, then, because I have two older children who are typical children, so I've been the mum to the child that doesn't have any extra needs, and now I'm the mum to a child that does, and it's completely changed me again.
I think it must be really different when you've got other kids as well. Like, I can't quite imagine that, because we've only had this experience as parents. And there was quite a lot of grief around that for a long time as well, because we didn't feel ready to have another child. I think initially, probably after a year or two, we would have had another one. But we were still working through all of our grief, and it took a few years. And then by the time we did feel ready, it was too late. We tried IVF and a few other things, but it wasn't to be. And again, it's something that I now, a few years later, I can look back on and think, actually, I'm really glad it didn't work out. It wasn't meant to be. Yeah. I wanted it, because I still hadn't fully accepted how things were. And I was like, oh, what would it be like to have a typical child, and for them to talk, and me to, then want to play games and like dress up and do, and because I'm a big, big, big kid and I love to do all that stuff, and I wanted that. But yeah, I think, with how high George's needs are and how much I can find, life a bit of a struggle sometimes anyway, I think it was absolutely the right thing that didn't work out. But yeah, I think it must be really difficult as well when, when you've got, they've got such differing needs as well, trying to kind of split yourself in both directions.
I mean, my situation's a bit different, because my two older children are much older. I've got a huge gap. Okay. I've got 17, 12 and 2.5.
Wow.
But I can imagine if you had children that were much closer together, and you had three young children, and the youngest had some kind of extra need, I think that would be incredibly difficult. My older two, I don't think that they really see Leo as any different to any other toddler. I think children just see things less, don't they? To them, he's just their baby brother, and they can help.
So that's
great for me. I think it's different for my husband. So the older two are from a previous relationship, so they're his stepchildren. So that brought up issues. I hope you wouldn't mind me saying this. That brought issues up for him of, this is the only child I'm going to have. So then that's something different again. I think me and you are roughly the same age. And unfortunately, biology means that I probably can't have any more children. I'm 43 now.
I'm going to be 43 in a couple of weeks.
I also don't have the patience to have two small children close together. I know.
I would definitely be carted off to the psychiatric unit.
Same. And I think maybe if I was younger or biology was different, then maybe I would have another child later, when we know how much help Leo's going to need. But, I agree with you, though. I'm a big believer in, this was what was meant to happen, and this was the baby that we were meant to have at this time.
Yeah. Now, hugely. That I wouldn't change him for the world. There are things I would do to make his life easier and our life easier. But he was exactly who we were meant to get.
What's that saying? I wouldn't change him for the world, but I'd change the world for him.
Oh yeah I
see people say that, and I love that. But I think let's be honest here, because this podcast is about being real. I've always said I want this to be a positive space, but I always want it to be real as well, otherwise there's kind of no point, is there?
No.
I want people to resonate, and I want this to help people, and for people to hear you talking or me talking or somebody else and go, oh God, I felt that. Oh God, yes. But like, there's a point, it takes a while to get to that acceptance. There's a big chunk where I was like, I would change this in a heartbeat if I could.
Absolutely.
And now I wouldn't, but it's a process, isn't it, to get to that.
It is. And, I think, I had years and years and years where I would have changed it, and that doesn't mean would have changed him, who he is, but there was so much upset and grief and anger around you know, why has this happened to him? Why has this happened to us? Like, why is life so difficult and it's so cruel? And why can't he see blossom trees? And why can't he, you know, talk and tell me how his day's been? And, you know, particularly when the first couple of years when he was in the mainstream, and I just found it, I would say, very distressing, sometimes bordering on traumatic, you know, to kind of go to the mainstream school and pick him up and see all the other kids and the other parents. And I just, it was just horrendous. I just, you know, I found it very, very painful.
Well, I guess that's constant comparison in your face, every drop off and every pickup, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I literally, I write poetry and I published a collection a couple of years ago. And I couldn't stop writing at that time about that experience of, you know, being so different and taking the long way around to walk around the back of the school where less of the mums walk past. And, you know, one of the mums was like, oh, do you want to join the WhatsApp group? This was his second year. So the first year I'd said yes, like people pleasing. Yeah, I'll join the WhatsApp group. And every time something came through with like, oh, so-and-so made a macaroni rainbow, or they've been doing a bug hunt this week. And I just was like, it was like rage. It was jealousy. It was bitterness. It was just like horrid. And the second year, one of the mums said, oh, she was lovely as well. I'm now really good friends with her. She said, you know, do you want to join the class WhatsApp? And I said, thank you for asking, but I really don't want to. I said, I find it really painful. And she was like, oh, okay. You know, and I don't feel like we fit in. I don't feel like we belong. We're so different. You know, and then when he started at a special school, that brought its own grief as well. You know, that was difficult as well. It's not anymore, actually. It's really not anymore. You know, I don't, every time I visit there now, I kind of tend to leave there feeling like, oh my God, all these beautiful children, this beautiful school, and it's just got the loveliest energy. And I'm like, yeah, actually, I'm kind of glad he is how he is. I know I see a lot of friends with like neurotypical kids who really, really struggle, you know, who are sensitive, and maybe they do have, you know, isms, maybe they've got, you know, milder autism or ADHD or whatever it is, yet they're expected to, in inverted commas, behave normally because it's not so obvious. Whereas George is not expected to, again, air quotes, behave normally. He's not expected to, so there's less pressure. But, you know, with a lot of these kids, it's really difficult for them. You know, there's that kind of, you know, that middle, there almost needs to be, you know, schools in the middle. There's special schools, there's mainstream schools, but there are also a lot of children these days who, you know, who really struggle and really need all that kind of sensory curriculum alongside, you know, the national curriculum, which is, I think that needs to really be addressed.
I completely agree with you. What was the decision to put him in mainstream school initially?
Denial. Absolute denial. And it was actually my mum who at one point said, I know this might be difficult to hear, but I think George needs to be in a special school. And I was like, oh no, I thought, no, he's just a bit slow. You know, he was still in, you know, nappies and drinking out of a baby bottle and, you know, couldn't speak. And I was like, no, because when he starts to talk and when he starts to learn, he'll be fine. It makes me feel sad now just even thinking that, you know, and I still have that glimmer of hope of one day he might talk, you know. You know, it's not likely, but yeah, it was mostly denial, but it was also before he started the mainstream, he went to a nursery for a couple of hours a day, which was like a Montessori nursery when he was two. That was lovely. He had like a one-to-one teaching assistant, and you know, we got his EHDP in place, and because the kids were little, it was a really nice environment. We then found it was kind of a special school, but it was kind of a nursery that did lots of kind of, you know, things for children with like movement disorder. So it was a conductive education school, and it was a charity run one. He went there for a year and it was so perfect for him. And unfortunately, they had closed their doors. We then
were like, funding.
Yeah, funding. Yeah. Just awful. Absolutely devastating. And it was, you know, it was like, you know, nearly an hour journey there, you know, there to get there and to get back, but it was worth it. Then we were like, you know, I was thinking mainstream, I'm not sure. Then COVID hit and he kind of got stuck in the mainstream for 2 years. And I knew by the second year, I was like, this is not right for him. We need to find a special school. And I looked at probably every special school in London. that was a very, I found that really difficult process. I found it really upsetting, like, you know, kind of acknowledging and accepting and admitting that I was like, this is what he needs. And, you know, seeing some of the other kids and thinking, well, he's not like that, or like, he, you know, and it's like, no, he is. But this particular school that he's at, we both walked through the doors, and on the website it didn't look that great. We were like, we'll just go and look at it. And we both walked in and went, yes, the energy felt right. It was warm, it was kind, it was inclusive. I love that they call the kids pre-verbal rather than non-verbal. I just thought that's so hopeful. And, you know, it's, yeah, so, you know, George has a very sensory program there, but I try and do quite a lot of, only recently I've started doing kind of more age-appropriate educational resources. I don't, you know, not for kind of 9-year-olds, but maybe things that are targeted at 5, 6, 7-year-olds. I'm kind of starting to, you know, read him books and play him stories that are a little bit older than what we've been playing him before. Just because I've been learning a lot and listening to a lot around, particularly around autism and children who have non-verbal autism or minimal speaking or unreliable speaking, so many of them who are now learning ways of sort of spelling to communicate actually have a higher than average intelligence. So it's just that their motor control doesn't allow their body to kind of function in the way that they want it to. And so what they talk about is presume competence, because you don't know. So I'm like, okay, he's not watching Peppa Pig anymore because he's 9, you know. Yeah, he still likes Ben and Holly, that's good, that's a bit, it's a little bit more story to it.
I quite like Ben and Holly.
I love Ben and Holly, so great. But yeah, I'm just kind of, you know, just getting him stuff that's a little bit more, you know, educational based, and I think he really is enjoying it. And I think, you know, even if he can't do anything with it in terms of, well, he's not going to have a job, for example. But, you know, it's kind of enriching for his mind. It's stimulating. And, you know, who knows what he's going to get from it.
Talking about communication then, if you think about somebody who is pre-verbal, there are resources available, and I've seen people use the programs on iPads, but obviously those things require your child to be able to see, to press the pictures or press the buttons. So how does communication look for George?
I think that's has been one of the most devastating things, because, you know, I've got a couple of friends where, you know, their kids are visually impaired and have other, you know, disabilities, but they're not blind. And so they can, you know, one of them can now use eye gaze, you know, a computer where he can kind of choose things that he wants. And then the other one is doing kind of Makaton signing, and is able to kind of point to pictures. Whereas for George, that's not a possibility. So, you know, we'd kind of tried on-body signing. So there's a type of on-body signing called Kanan-Bari, which is a bit of a strange thing. And he's nailed a couple of the signs. So the drink sign he can do. A couple of them, though, they're not really in context. So he knows how to do the toilet sign, for example, but he won't do it when he needs the toilet. If I say he can do the toilet sign, he'll do it, but he won't tell me that he needs the toilet, for example. So, again, makes me think about this kind of motor thing, because I've always said, you know, he understands everything. I'm like, you know, he understands words, he laughs at jokes, like, in all the right places, you know. If I give him a new medication, let's say, you know, a new epilepsy medication that's got a complicated name like lamotrigine, you know, I give it to him. The second day I'll say, oh, here's your lamotrigine, and he'll go like that and open his mouth. So, you know, he understands language. Mm-hmm. He seems to understand everything, but it's this difficulty in kind of, you know, it coming, getting out and expressing the other way. So something that I've very recently stumbled across, and I was talking about this earlier, this kind of non-verbal autistic kids, some of them are using this kind of spelling to communicate method, or rapid prompting method. It's, you know, they call it spelling broadly. So this spelling mainly relies on sight, so that they can kind of see a letter on a letterboard and point to it. And I was listening to stuff about it, reading about it, and I thought, oh my God, is there any way that this could work for George? and I kind of contacted a few people. They were like, you know, it does kind of require sight. And then I came across one blind, totally blind, non-verbal autistic speller who is doing it by feeling the foam letters. So you could kind of go, well, why wouldn't you just do Braille then? But, you know, Braille is far more complex, and it's those tiny little dots, and, you know, it requires a lot of motor planning, and it requires you to not be kind of tactile defensive, which, you know, a lot of blind children are, including George. So I'm now in touch with a spelling teacher, and what we're doing is we're getting him we've got some boards coming with like foam letters on, and we, you know what, it may not be possible. We don't know cognitively if it's a possibility, but I'm willing to try, and it might take 10 years. And I wish someone could say to me, if you do this for 15 minutes every day, in 10 years, they'll be able to communicate. But what I am seeing is these kids that have been labelled as intellectually disabled, who are nonverbal autistic, when they're spelling, they are super bright, super intelligent, and using really complex language. But they'll say, you know, people think I'm, you know, not intelligent because I can't toilet myself, or I can't control my body, or I make funny sounds, you know, or I sit there rocking. And actually, these kids are super, super bright, like crazily intelligent. So it's kind of blown open my mind recently, and I'm really, you know, looking into it. I'm teaching him his letters and spelling, in the hope that perhaps one day he might be able to communicate with it. But even if he doesn't, we're both enjoying it. He loves it. He really smiles, and I think he loves that I'm kind of, you know, and yeah, stimulating and presuming. I'm talking to him in a different way as well. I feel like I'm not that I've ever used super simple language with him, but I feel like I'm just talking to him in a more age appropriate way. Whereas I've always been like, oh, he's my baby. And of course he's my baby. Even when he's 6'3", like his dad, he'll still be my baby. And, you know, but, yeah, just trying to broaden, you know, his understanding of the world.
Well, it's all a learning curve, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just going to stay the same the whole time.
Exactly, yeah. And I think so many experiences that I've done with him, knowing that he is probably not going to enjoy it, he might tolerate it, or he might cry, but he'll know a little bit more about the world. So when he hears on a story that he's listening to that they're going ice skating, even though I know, you know, he can't do ice skating, I was like, let's go ice skating so that you can feel the ice, you know what that is. Just so that you know what it is. You know, he hated it. I fell over. He hated it. He cried. I cried. But I'm like, you know what ice is. You know what ice skating is. You know what, when Elsa in Frozen turns into ice, you know what that is. You know, it makes more sense of the world for him. So I remember once on Peppa Pig, it was Miss Rabbit's helicopter. And I was saying to him, oh, I was trying to describe what a helicopter is, but it's really difficult if you can't see where the sky is. You know, I was like, it's kind of really up high in the sky. So I got the fan out and I made this propeller sound, and I was like, it kind of feels like this. And I went, you know what? I went, fuck it. I was like, let's go on a helicopter. So I just booked a helicopter ride for us. He screamed, he hated it because it was so loud. But I was like, but you know what one is now, you know?
I love that mentality though. That's great.
Yeah. See, he's like, oh my God, what are you doing with him now? It's like, what mad idea.
Just off in a helicopter and then going ice skating. Why?
I'm like, oh, why? What are you doing? Yeah. You know, like I remember thinking, oh, how's he going to know what a boat is? And like, I was like, even if we went on a ferry, you can't see the water. You can't feel the water. How do you know you're on a ferry? So I was like, what we need is we need to go on a speedboat, because then he'll get splashed and he'll feel the wind and the kind of movement. So we did that. The first time we did it, he cried. He hated it. The second time, because he knew what to expect, he loved it, because he loves the wind so much. Oh. And now we go on a speedboat for his birthday every year, and he's just like, great fun.
That just shows, doesn't it, about, you know, you've said, oh, the first time he hated it. Well, you could have just given up then and gone, oh, he hates it, never mind. And actually now you persevering, it's turned into something that is a tradition for your family that he loves.
Yeah, and it's that knowing what to expect as well. You know, like when we went to the fair the other day, and it's the first time we must have been to a fair, I don't know, maybe 20 times over the years. And this was the first time he smiled and enjoyed it on every ride, and he knew what to expect. So I'd go, right, this is the runaway train, so remember this one, it goes round and then it goes up the hill and then down the hill. Or you know, these are the flying elephants that are going to go up. And he loved it. And I got so much joy from it. And I was, yeah, you know, sometimes it doesn't go great and I come home crying. And there have been times where I've given up and thought, I don't want to go anywhere. I can understand why people avoid it, because it's painful. It's difficult if they don't enjoy it, or if people look, or, you know, you're kind of doing those comparisons. But yeah, when I can, I do.
Have you had bad experiences from other people?
You know what? Not many at all, actually. In fact, I would say 99.9% of people's reactions are incredible, loving, generous, kind, compassionate, supportive, overwhelmingly lovely. You know, there's always the odd thing, and it's usually, you know, innocent comments from smaller children that really hurt. You know, they don't mean any harm, but they just don't understand, or they go like, why is his eyes funny, or why has he got a nappy on, or, you know, it's those little things, or why can't you talk? And I'm like, you know, and I'm trying to explain to them, and then I come home from the park and just sob, because it's painful, you know.
Yeah, my husband had that the other day. We took Leo to soft play. So I can see now that Leo will walk. So he's 2.5, but he isn't walking independently yet. He can like cruise around, you know, and hold on to things. But and he can walk very slowly if you hold his hand. But he's not. I wouldn't say anywhere close to walking. Although it's funny, isn't it? You all have had this as well. You know, people assume that they're going to do the same as typical children. So now as soon as he stood up, loads of people, my friends, family, well-meaning people were, oh my God, he's going to be off. And I was like, no, he won't. Yeah. Because it took him about 6 months to crawl after he could first put his hand, you know, in front of the other. He would do four and then be on his belly. So I'm like, no, he isn't going to be walking soon. Like, let's stop saying that, because it's not. But anyway, we're in the soft play, and a little girl came up to my husband and said, oh, how old is he? And Ben said, oh, he's 2.5. And she went, oh, I thought he was younger than that, because he's not walking. Mm. And my sister's only one and she's walking. And it's obviously they're children. It's completely innocent. Yeah. But that really upset him.
Yeah, it is. And I think particularly in the first few years, it's really destabilizing and really deeply upsetting. You know, you have your good days and your terrible days. And it does get better and it does get easier. But also, I think, you know, we don't kind of knock around with neurotypical kids that much. You know, we used to try and kind of fit in a little bit, you know, and, you know, we'd have a couple of sort of pals from, you know, the mainstream school that he kept in touch with a little bit, they'd come and see him. But then as they grew older, I was just like, this is just not working. Like, it doesn't work. And it's painful for me, you know, like one of them would like be running off in the forest and I would be like trying to carry him and keep up. And I was like, this is not us. This is just not how we are. And our lives are different. You know?
That's an acceptance thing, isn't it? Because sometimes I think with those things, certainly this is how my brain works anyway, you're doing those things to go, see, well, we can do this because you do this. So we'll still carry on doing this, even though no one's having a nice time.
Yeah.
And then actually you're trying to do it for you rather than for them because they aren't benefiting from it. And actually you're not benefiting it from it either. Like nobody is.
And like now I just focus on the things that I know he enjoys, you know, like, and I know that he doesn't want a birthday party because he hates having too many people around. He gets overwhelmed and he screams and then I get upset and I'm like, you know what? I don't like parties either. And I was like, we're not going to have parties anymore. Stop it. We're not doing it. You know, and we did it for years and years and years. And I was just like, this is too painful. I'm not doing it. So now we'll be like, right, George, you're going to hang out with mummy. We're going to go on the speedboat. And then we're going to go swimming with daddy later, because they're the things we know you love. You love being with us. You love swimming. You love, you know, going on the swings. You love your music and, you know, just stuff that we know, you know, rather than like buying him toys. He doesn't like toys. He doesn't want toys. He's not interested. He's not going to play with toys. What he does like is experiences. So I'm like, right, let's go on the Polar Express. You know, let's listen to Christmas music. Like, you know, let's get you a new choo-choo necklace because you like them. You know, he doesn't want a neurotypical toy. He just doesn't, you know. And we had years and years and years of stuff like in his room that people have bought, you know, really lovely, well-meaning. And I was like, you know, at some point I was just ready to let go of it. And I was like, that's all right. It was painful, but it was okay.
Yeah, but that's another thing, isn't it? That you, I mean, maybe birthday parties, grief is too strong a word, but there is an element of grieving with those things that you assumed that you would get to do.
Yeah.
Before you have a child, you think, oh, we're going to, oh, imagine like, you know, is maybe, I don't know, people do these now, like, oh, we can do like a cake smash and have those pictures, or we can have a big birthday party and have someone bring animals round, and oh my God, isn't it going to be lovely when they're unwrapping their presents? And those are meaningful things to let go of, aren't they?
Yeah. It's interesting as well, you say with the wrapping paper, let's say, hate the touch and the sound of wrapping paper. And also, what's the point in wrapping paper for kind of for a blanket? It's like, it's to conceal what the present is. And I'm like, you don't know what it is anyway. And I can kind of like, so now I'm like, I don't wrap them anymore. I just put them in a box. And I'm like, and then he doesn't want to put his hand in the box. I'm like, it's okay. And I still can get upset about it. But more and more, it gets easier every year that passes. And pretty much now we just enjoy him. We absolutely, we enjoy him so, so much. He's so much fun, and quite often I honestly, hand on heart, can say I'm really grateful that it is like this, that it's turned out like this. Like, most of the time I'm like, this is perfect. You know, it's hard, it's painful, there are days where it's, you know, exhausting and, you know, really upsetting, particularly with, you know, things like seizures and the kidney failure, and they're things that are extremely painful, you know, fear of him dying, fear of losing him, all of that stuff is very, very difficult to deal with. And you know, I'm really fortunate that I can afford to see a therapist once a week, and have done since he was born. And you know, I know not everyone can do that, but it really has helped me so much to have a place to go. And more than that, to, you know, be able to talk to my partner and a handful of close friends who, you know, some I've met who are other Send mums, you know, since George was born, and others who are just old friends, you know, or friends that are kind of in recovery programs, you know, just to be able to at least a handful of times a week, you know, check in, have a cry, say what's going on, say I've just been to the park, I've come home, I'm gutted, or say, oh my God, he just did this thing and it was amazing. You know, that connecting and that sharing is what has saved me. You know, it's got me through. Yeah,
we're still having the therapy. I mean, we're lucky because we got it on the NHS. I don't know how much longer that's going to last for us, but we got super, super lucky with ours. Like, he just got it from the beginning. And I think it's a place, isn't it, where you can say things that maybe you wouldn't want to say to your friends.
I'm probably a bit, not brutally honest, I don't mean as in, you know, with, but I kind of, I'm very, very, very open with my emotions. And I know that can be uncomfortable for some people. And that's okay. It's just how I am. And I feel things very deeply. And, you know, I know which friends to share it with, you know, who can hold it and let me just be without trying to fix it or say, but, oh, it's all right, because his hearing will be better. I just want you to hear me. I just want to have a cry, be angry, you know, and that's it. And it really helps.
I'd be interested to know, if you don't mind me asking, did you and your partner deal with it at the beginning in the same way? Because obviously, you know, you're talking about this beautiful life that the three of you have, but I can understand why a diagnosis of any kind, and certainly some of the things that you have discussed and how hard things are, could completely destroy relationships. And obviously it does. If you don't deal with it in the same way. Did you at the beginning?
I think it's really, we're really fortunate that Steve and I met in a 12-step recovery fellowship many years ago. You know, we were both already in therapy, weekly therapy, before we had George. So, you know, our, you know, for nearly 20 plus years, our lives have been, you know, about that kind of, you know, honesty and emotional awareness and intelligence. And having said that, there were still difficulties. You know, I think the first couple of years, probably my denial and researching and like, well, we're going to just do everything anyway, was completely at odds with Steve's, who was, you know, perhaps more, you know, found it painful to go places like the park or swimming or, you know, so I kind of did everything with George on my own for quite a few years. that's really changed now. So we do a lot more stuff together.
That's nice.
And he says he's a bit gutted that he missed out on the earlier years of going and doing stuff with him. He said, you know, and I really admire that you just go and do it. And, you know, even though it's painful sometimes, but that's just kind of his way and my way, you know. And we've kind of, you know, we've gone from kind of polar opposites to coming far more together on it over the last 3 or 4 years or so, 3 years maybe.
That's really nice to hear, because to a certain extent that echoes how me and my partner have been at the beginning. He found it extremely difficult to be happy going out and seeing other children.
Yeah.
And having been a mum before, I knew how important it was to have that circle of mum friends who you can text at 3 o'clock in the morning because you're up feeding the baby when they're tiny. And I made a real effort to make those friends. And those friends that I made have typical children. So going to those first birthday parties and things like that, my husband found really triggering. So it was the same, basically, as what you've just said. So I was just like, okay, I'll go. But then I felt a tiny bit of resentment there.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, well, I'm kind of going. It would be nice for you to come with me. Like, how come... I need to check he's all right for me to not edit this out. But it was a little bit of like, well, how come you get to sit at home and not face it, but I don't?
I really, really understand that. I can understand both sides of it.
No, I can completely.
I think it's that. And I definitely felt, you know, I got to a point where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I feel like I'm a single parent, like, and it's not, I can't do it. And, you know, my big part in that was not communicating it as I was going along because of like fear of confrontation and conflict and not wanting to feel bad and da da da. And actually, over the last few years, we communicate so much better, you know, and we're so much happier and as a family, you know, and we do a lot more stuff together. And we also don't put pressure on the other one, you know, as much. And, you know, I often would say I kind of have this tunnel vision, like when I'm out with George at the park or swimming or, you know, on my own or at the fair or whatever it is, I'm like it's just him and me. Like, I try not to kind of look out too much, and if I'm just looking at him, then it's the joy, you know. And if I start comparing, so what they call like compare and despair, you know, comparing your outside to someone else's insides, I mean, and also it's okay to feel that pain. It's important and it's useful. You don't need to avoid what these days people would call triggers, you know. Like, you know, I might make a choice now to go, you know what, I'm not going to go to that kid's birthday party because I know I'll find that really painful, and also George will fucking hate it. Like, he doesn't want to go, neither of us want to go, let's not go, you know. That's different to me just like, you know, completely avoiding everything. And because I'm like, I don't want to feel upset, I don't want to feel angry. You know, I need to feel upset. I've needed to feel angry. I've needed to feel jealous. I've needed to feel the whole spectrum of these huge feelings in order to get to a place where I have a bit more peace and acceptance, you know, and it's been worth it.
It's interesting, though, you're right in saying that it's about communication, because there's a lot of big, bad feelings, aren't there, around things like this?
Yeah.
And if you can't speak to each other about them, I would imagine that's where big problems start to happen. And I don't know if lucky's the right word, but it is, in a way, that you and your partner had that background of going through the 12-step program, so that, like you say, you're used to those big, bad emotions and being able to verbalise them to each other.
That's kind of our language. We don't really do small talk. We're just like, how do you feel? Like, don't ask them how they feel, for God's sake. They'll tell you.
That's great.
But we laugh so much. You know, we laugh so much. Steve always says, you know, we'd laugh if we were, you know, in a, what is it, the gallows. He said we'd still find something to make us laugh, even no matter how inappropriate it is. You know, he says that's why we're not on Gogglebox, babe, because we're really inappropriate. And I'm not going to tell you any examples here because...
So when you do have those bad days, we all have the bad days, you know, with you, with George, whether it is something medical like a seizure or whether it's just one of those days where you're like, this is shit, why is this happening to us? How do you cope with those feelings?
So I have a couple of strategies, and it depends on what frame of mind I'm in and how much time I've got, and whether I can. One of those strategies is kind of facing it and dealing with it, and the other is denying it and distracting. And they're both useful and important for me, distracting and denial. That could be reading my phone until one in the morning. It could be smoking and drinking coffee. It could be falling asleep and just not like blocking out everything, you know, watching telly, whatever it is, anything to kind of get away from it. Yeah. That stuff is okay. Like I don't have a problem with that. But alongside it, I have to do the working through the stuff as well. Otherwise it gets really unmanageable. So for me, the biggest tools are calling people that I know that can listen and hold it, not people who, you know, are uncomfortable with emotion. It might be just a 10-minute call to a recovery friend or, you know, a close friend or even a family member if you've got someone who can hold that stuff. Have a cry, you know, have a phone call, have a cry. The other thing for me is I set a timer on my phone for 3 minutes and I do a stream of consciousness. I write as fast as I can without censoring it. And that can be, you know, you can write the things that you think, oh my God, if anyone knew I thought that, you know, they'd lock me up or they'd hate me or they'd think I was a terrible person. The more you get those thoughts out, the thoughts that you, air quotes, shouldn't have, the better, because they're just fucking thoughts. It doesn't matter. You know, once you get them out of your head and onto a page, no one's going to see it. You can tear it up, you can burn it, stick it in the drawer, whatever. But it's important not to censor it, not to write what you think you should write. You know, it's like, I'm fucking raging about this and I wish, and why did this happen? And it's not fair and I hate it and I wish I'd never even had a baby, blah, 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 all that stuff. It doesn't mean it's true. It's just getting it out. So the writing for me.
I love that.
Yeah, it's my
most valuable. I want to try that.
Honestly, I don't know where I'd be without that. You know, and then the other thing I do is I do tapping videos on YouTube. So I might do a breathing exercise, a little tapping video, so EFT tapping. Again, it's like a really quick, simple thing that you can do that calms your nervous system, helps you to kind of express your feelings, what's going on. And, you know, ultimately, when you express whatever it is, sadness, anger, you know, rage, grief, whatever, when you do that and allow it to have its full cycle, then your adrenaline and cortisol comes down and you become more parasympathetic, you become calmer, you can deal with the day. You know, like if I just keep running and distracting, you know, whether that's, you know, I've been sober a long time, but you know, it could be, you know, drinking excessive amounts of wine in the evening or whatever it is, like I would be like, don't give yourself a hard time about it. But if it's becoming an issue, you know, something's not working for you anymore, or it's becoming, you know, unmanageable and out of control, then, you know, yeah, therapy, if that's an option, if that's available. But if not, you know, the writing and the talking help more than anything.
I think those are really helpful things you've just said there, because firstly, they're free. And exactly. Secondly, they're quick things.
Yeah.
And the things that you've just said, obviously tapping, you might not want to do in public because people might think, who's that weirdo over there doing that? But you don't need to be in a certain room in your house, or you could do those things in the car. Now,
I do it in the car. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm one of these classic people that goes, oh, I meditate. I've now accepted I don't meditate. I meditated like 4 times over the course of 4 months and went, oh, God, yeah, I meditate. It's really helpful.
Yeah.
I just can't find... I mean, you can always find the time for anything, can't you? But for me, I find it extremely difficult. It does help because I have a constantly busy mind. But to meditate, you have to be in the right frame of mind. You have to find somewhere quiet. The kids have to not be making a noise. Someone has to not knock on the door. You have to remember to put your phone on silent. And I think the things that you've just said feel much more accessible, certainly to me, than finding 20 minutes to lie down in a completely quiet room and meditate, which I just find ridiculously hard for some reason.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, that's not something that works well for me. I do have a very, very busy, blah, 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 crazy radio head that just doesn't shut up. You know, so for me, active things like, you know, doing a 3-minute breathing technique, which I can do in the car, or tapping while I'm in the car, you know, just calling someone while I'm in the car. It's always when I'm in the car because that's the only time I have, you know, when I'm driving to work. I've got some time. You know, making it accessible and achievable. You know, like you said, not having to carve out an hour to do like, oh, this huge routine of self-care. Like, no, 3 minutes, you know, even if George is in the lounge, I can still sit there and write, scribble in my notebook and have a cry. And I don't have to hide it from him, my tears. I can just say, Mummy's feeling a bit sad, I'm having a cry. It's healthy to let it out, isn't it? You know, and then he knows that that's all right. Okay.
No, I love those things. I think actually they're going to be really helpful for people, because you see a lot at the minute about self-care routines, and sometimes it feels really difficult to build that into your day, especially when you've got a lot going on. And then sometimes you fall into that trap, don't you, of going, right, I'm going to meditate every day, or I'm going to do this every day. And then you realise you haven't done it for a week and you're like, oh, well, I failed. It's too difficult. I can't do it. Bye.
Yeah. I like the 3-minute timer thing, because I'm like, I can do 3 minutes. That's fine. Then I can go and have a coffee and a cigarette. Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. Anyone can do 3 minutes.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm going to try those. And I like the tapping in the car as well. I feel like I could talk to you forever, but I just looked at the time and I'm like,
George will be back soon.
I know, right. So my last two questions are the same to each of my guests. And the first one is, what is the best piece of advice that you've been given along the way?
I think the best piece of advice is probably, and this would kind of mainly apply to children who have autism or autistic people, was changing his diet. We were advised to change his diet. We saw a functional health practitioner just for a couple of sessions on Zoom a few years ago. And she said, you know, a lot of children with autism are not able to process certain foods because they're sensitive to it or their body can't process them. So she said, you know, try this diet. It was a massive change because it was gluten-free, grain-free, dairy-free, which then at the time I was like, well, what's left? Like, oh my God. And she said, you know, that the first few days that you take him off gluten, he will behave like an addict withdrawing from something. And I was like, surely not. That's ridiculous. And she was absolutely right. And it was very difficult. And what happened was he went from, you know, kind of self-harming behaviors, you know, scratching, like not connecting at all, not engaging, becoming more and more in his own world, you know, more and more distressed. You know, his sleep was horrendous. And when we changed the diet, within a week or so of being on that diet, he has been like a different child. He is calmer, he sleeps better, he's more engaged, he's more connected, he's happier. And if he ever has something with a tiny amount of any of those foods in by accident, he can be up all night biting, scratching, you know, he's wired and he can't. And it just shows me how sensitive some of these kids are to, you know, diet and, you know, what's kind of in their environment, you know. And that can be a huge task. And it's not possible for everyone, particularly with autistic kids, because a lot of autistic kids are very choosy about what they can eat and what they will eat. So, you know, I know it's not doable for everyone. Fortunately, it was and is doable for us. He's been on that about 6 years now, and it's life-changing, absolutely life-changing. So that was the best bit of information she ever gave us.
Well, there's a lot of research being done now, isn't there, into how food can affect or does affect brain function. And it's stuff that's come out in the last few days about ultra-processed foods, and eliminating or hugely cutting down on ultra processed foods can help reduce, obviously not get rid of, because that's not how, you know, neurodiversity works, but can reduce symptoms of ADHD in children, well, and adults.
Absolutely. And autism. Yeah, absolutely.
So interesting. Yeah. And the other question is, what do you wish you'd known when you got, well, any of George's diagnosis, I guess?
I wish I'd known that it's all going to be okay. I can regret a little bit, you know, the amount of time and the depth of the grief, you know, but it was all part of the process and I needed to go through that. And I just wish I could have, I mean, I did enjoy it. I enjoyed every moment of him. Like, I absorbed him and I was like, oh, you know, the love and the time spent together. But I just kind of wish that I could have seen me now and go, it's going to be all right, you know, you're going to accept it, it's going to be fine, you're going to be happy, he's going to be happy, it's all right, you know. And that probably is the most obvious thing to say, but it's what comes to mind.
No, it's not obvious at all, and some of my previous guests have said that, but I think that's super helpful for people who are at the beginning of their journey to hear. And it's important to hear people say, exactly what you've just said. Like, yeah. Yes, it feels really, really, really shit now, but, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years on, it doesn't. Like, yeah. It's fine.
It does. Yeah, seriously. And, you know, that kind of, it's really helped me to have a couple of, like, SEN mums who I can be really honest with about that stuff. And some of them were, you know, a couple of them were further ahead than me on the journey. And to be able to talk to them and hear that gave me so much hope. So hopefully, yeah. You know, this does the same for someone who is in the first few years and in that tougher time. And, you know, it's one day at a time. So, you know, we can go to jump to the future and, oh, you know, who's going to look after him when I'm not here? And, like, of course I'm going to think about that stuff. We're going to, you know, have sleepless nights and tears and that's all part of it. But it's also that, you know, just for today, just for today. Yeah.
100%. Ebony, I've enjoyed chatting to you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been so lovely to chat to you. Thank you for having me.
I had so many questions written down for Ebony then that I didn't even ask because I just felt like we had a really nice chat and I could have carried on chatting to her for ages. There were so many things that I wanted to know and ask and find out. But obviously, you know, we're all parents. People only have a limited amount of time. And also people only have a limited amount of time to listen to podcasts as well, which I'm well aware of. So, you know, if you have listened all the way through this episode, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time as well as Ebony taking the time to be a guest. But I loved that chat. You know, it's just another example of a mum facing some really challenging times sometimes, you know, in a neurodiverse way and a medical way, and still having this gorgeous positive outlook on life, but at the same time acknowledging that there are some really hard times and sometimes it doesn't feel great. And that's the whole vibe that I wanted for this podcast, and hopefully it's achieving it. So once again, thank you so much to Ebony for being my latest guest on the Send Mum Club. And if you enjoyed this episode or any of the others, I know I say at the end, it's probably getting quite boring now if you've listened to all of them, but I would love you to leave a review and I would love you to rate as well, because what that does, as well as allow me to get some feedback, and you can always, by the way, please do message me and let me know what you think of the episodes at the Send Mum Club on Instagram. But by rating and reviewing on your podcast app, it just means that more people get to find the podcast, and I would love that. And you know what? Some people have been suggesting questions, suggesting guests. If you know someone like Ebony, because that's how she came to me through a mutual friend, if you know somebody who you think, oh my God, you have to speak to my friend or my sister or whoever it is, I would love you to get in touch and let me know with guest suggestions, anything you want covered in the questions. I am super up for feedback. So thank you for listening, and I will see you again next Monday.